This is Everyday Bravery.
So, my parents divorced when I was 17. And then I didn't have contact with my father for many years after that. In my mind, he had forgotten about me, and I decided that I wanted to contact my father. So we met at this cafe, and he was totally like, "It's so good to see you, and you've grown up," and as if nothing had happened. And so we small talked for about 15 minutes, but I remember that I was quite scared is the wrong word, but I was really nervous and like sweating profusely in my overalls, trying to summon, you know, intense courage. I think he then said, you know, "Did you do well at school? Did you pass all your courses?" And I just lost it. I was like, "Pass my courses? Like, I want a scholarship every year at the end of the year. You have no idea who I am." And then there was a pause in the conversation. And then I just blurted out, "Where have you been?" And then it was like the exorcist, because then my bravery just kind of was unleashed, and then I couldn't stop. And I think that most of the people in the restaurant were like, "What is going on at that table?" And, you know, he would say things like, "Oh, well, I didn't know," or, "Oh, I knew what was going on. I knew you would be fine. I knew you were at a good university." And so eventually he was kind of backed into a corner. And then, and I must say that it really touched me that he then was quite vulnerable and sort of said, "I was weak and wasn't able to do it, and I'm sorry." He was scared of rejection, which I found extremely touching. And now, my father and I have a fairly good relationship. I'm not sure we would have gotten there had I not really taken him to task.
When Zorana agreed to meet her estranged father, she was going to let him have it. But then, she listened to what he had to say. Because of that, she was able to forgive him and could accept him for who he was. Forgiveness and acceptance. It can be some of the hardest things we do. Today, stories to inspire you to do just that. I'm Meg Wilcox, and here's how Everyday Bravery forgives and accepts. From Prudential. When you're a kid, you're told if you put your head down and work hard, it'll pay off. You're told to treat people the way you want to be treated. You're told, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. Follow the rules and you'll be rewarded. And for some people, that's how it works. But for others, life isn't that simple. Damian Cooper grew up in a rough neighborhood in Baltimore. When he was a kid, his parents taught him to study hard, go to church, respect his elders, build his community, and live with compassion. So that's what he did. And life was working out for him. He went to college on a wrestling scholarship. He was doing well in school. Everything was going according to plan. He was happy. But like I said, life isn't always that simple.
It was Tuesday, October 13th, 1992. I remember we just finished wrestling practice. I'm leaving campus with my friends. But I knew my mom had made ribs and greens, and that was the dinner I was looking forward to when I got home that night. So I had to catch the number 5 bus to get home. When I got the bus, I crossed the street. It was a street called Sinclair Lane. And I decided just to take the quickest path to get home, which was cut across the school field, which is dark, there had no lights. I had on some headphones. I got right beside my house. I felt someone behind me, and I turned around. When I turned around, there was 2 guys there. And I vividly remember the guy that had on his shirt that looked like the shirt that Charlie Brown wore. He was the one to pull the trigger. I smelled like sulfur. My ears were ringing. My skin was burning. I had no idea that I had been shot. The only thing I can vividly remember is me cursing and being upset because they put a hole in my jacket. And I didn't realize that I had a hole in my chest and I was bleeding to death. My stepdad came out the house. I started to cough up blood, and I didn't want my mom to see it. And so I wouldn't spit the blood out. Instead, I swallowed it. That was a big mistake because I began to choke off my own blood. I remember getting into the ambulance, and the pain just wouldn't stop. I kept telling the female paramedic that I was sleepy and I just wanted to take a nap. And I vividly remember her telling me, she said, "Baby, if you close your eyes, you're never going to open them again." She said, "If you just do me a favor, she said, if you count the streetlights, we'll get you to the hospital." The actual recovery was about 2 years because I had to lay flat on my back for 2 years. I couldn't take a shower or a bath for myself. Someone would actually have to pick me up. Psychologically, I was so damaged, I didn't want to do anything except stay in the house and hide. Yeah, I was honestly too afraid to go to school. Anytime I would hear a car backfire, if I heard a balloon burst, anything that sounded like a gunshot would freak me out. I had no idea who shot me. Even though the guy shot me at point-blank range, I could not remember how they looked whatsoever. So it's December 31st, 1996, 4 years since I've been shot. On New Year's Eve in Baltimore, a lot of people decide to take out guns and shoot at midnight. I decided I was going to take my stepfather's gun and I was going to end my life that night. I didn't know what else to do. Two of my friends, they rang my doorbell and they asked me would I go to church with them. I didn't need to go to church. There was no need to go to church because there was nothing for me there. When I was young, I was an altar boy, and I've always been a man of faith, always attended church. But during that time, I honestly blame God. Why would he allow me to get shot? And I remember sitting in my apartment, and I can hear them steadily screaming up to my window, you know, "We're not going to leave until you agree to go to church with us." So I said, "Fine, I'll go." We go into the church and we walk up the steps and I sit directly in the back. I was going to slide out the back door of that church and go. Reverend Cole sat there and just talked to us about that we all go through our night seasons. And I remember him open up his Bible and he said, "We're going to go to one scripture in the Bible." It was in the book of Psalms, Psalms 30, verse 5, which read, "For his anger endureth but a moment, and his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning." And he said, "If you just hold on, your joy will come." It felt like he was only talking to me. I felt like warm and just happy for once that I haven't felt in a long time. I didn't feel the anger. I couldn't be that guy anymore. I couldn't be the angry guy, because it wasn't getting me anywhere. I knew I had to do things different. I had to forgive the man that put a hole in my chest. Because for 4 years, 2 months, and 18 days, he held that kind of power over me. He could have been living a good life. I didn't know it. And I was just messed up from a bullet being put in my chest. I knew I had to forgive him. I remember running to the front of that church. I mean, I was crying uncontrollably. And I remember the pastor of the church just grabbed me and he hugged me. And he just kept saying, "Welcome home, welcome home." That's all he kept saying to me. From there, I went back to college. I graduated and got a degree. And instead of going to get an MBA, I decided to go study about God. A seminary is a place that you go to get theological training. I met a guy by the name of Chaplain Christopher Wallace, and Chaplain Wallace oversaw many of the prisons in Baltimore City. So we would go to the prison and work with these men on etiquette, resume writing, those kind of things to give them some marketable skills for when they were about to come home. The blessing in me being shot is the fact that I'm able to talk to young men or young women who feel like they can't go on. I'm able to talk to somebody who very well may want to shoot or stab or kill somebody. When he saw me, either he would call me, you know, hey, DC, hey, Coop. He would call me Damo. He would call me Minister Coop. We would talk. So there was a measure of trust. So I learned the fact that he was the guy in the neighborhood who was always picked on. His dad was killed in prison. His mom didn't make a whole lot of money. She strung out on drugs. He had to be the one taking care of his sisters. So he decided to get with the wrong crowd. And during that time, he had to prove to them that he was worthy of being around these guys. So as we're talking and I'm asking him, you know, hey, I'm going through the same checklist I usually go through. Are there any crimes that you committed that you were never charged for? And he knew that he was in a safe place, so he was free and open to tell me. He said, me and my boy saw this dude get off the number 5 bus. We saw him cross the street, Sinclair Lane. We followed him through the schoolyard, and we followed him as he walked down the street. He had no idea who was behind him. And he said, my boy told me, yo, if you're going to do it, you got to do it now. He said, so we ran up on him. And said he turned around, he had this look on his face. And he said, before anything could be said, I pulled the trigger. I pulled the trigger and I bust him. And as he said that, I stopped. And from there, I proceeded to unbutton my shirt. And he had this look on his face of fight or flight because he didn't know what was about to happen. And I pulled down my T-shirt and I showed him the hole in my chest. And I said, you shot me. So he sat there and I told him that I forgave him during a church service on December 31st, 1996. That I told this man to his face in this prison that I forgive you. And he didn't know how to handle that. He broke down in tears, and we dealt with everything right there. I never turned him in. This was finally done. This young man now is a father of two. He now has his associate's degree from Baltimore City Community College. And every single Saturday, like clockwork, we talk. We both need to continue to hold each other up to remember what happened, because I don't think anyone comes out inherently bad. You're taught to hate. You're taught to fear. You're taught these things. I'm actually able to see the man that shot me flourish. That does a whole lot for me.
Damian Cooper's work with Baltimore inmates inspired the work he does now. He founded an organization in Baltimore called Project NUMA. It's an after-school program supporting inner-city African-American boys. One of the values of the program is teaching, among other things, how to forgive others. Find out more at projectnuma.org, or you can find a link in the show notes to this episode. It's amazing how people can learn to forgive and accept others once they find the courage to speak up.
I fell in love with Tom, who is African American. I knew right away that I would have to lose my mother and father over it. I accepted for life that I would never see my parents again. They were people of the South. My father was a little more pliable. It was my mother. She said, I think you're going to live in a project, poor and unhappy. You know, that's the only thing she could visualize in marrying an African American. Tom was the one who said, I am going to contact your parents. and see if they will meet with us. And I said, forget it. That is a waste of time. But he was so wonderful, and he knew how to do it. Sure enough, he contacted them, and it turned out beautifully.
There was this one friend that I have known my whole life, and one day we were sitting there with a bunch of friends, and he started to talk about the immigrant situation, and he started to talk about how they don't provide us anything but trouble, that they don't have anything to offer, you know? And I'm not an immigrant, but it hurt me when I was hearing him say this because of the people around me. I didn't want them to hear my friends say that. From that day on, I forgave him, but I moved on, and I distanced myself, and I started to do that every day with more and more people that you can love at a distance almost, you know? You can forgive, but you can also forget almost, you know? So.
Brenda Smith's great-granddaughter was born premature. She was born with many physical disabilities and health problems. Doctors warned that her life, assuming she'd survive being born, would be a difficult one. So Brenda stepped in to lend a hand. She suspected that supporting the tiny newborn could be a life-altering responsibility, but she couldn't realize at the time just how much this choice would overwhelm her. She couldn't know that by accepting her great-granddaughter's life and all its challenges, it would go on to define her own life so clearly. Brenda is in Loosedale, Mississippi.
All right, you there, Brenda?
Yes.
So we'll just get you to start from, you were saying that people didn't know that anything was wrong, so we'll just start from there again.
Okay, it was my granddaughter. She was 30 weeks into the pregnancy. She went in to get an ultrasound to see if it was a boy or a girl. And that's when the ultrasound showed the umbilical cord had been detached. And then the doctors came in and said there was problems and they needed to get the baby out. But he said she's so tiny and underdeveloped that you really need to decide whether you can handle this or if you feel like it would be more than you could cope with. She said, if she survives the birth, I want to take care of her.
Could you tell me about the first time that you actually saw Shaylin?
Oh, I can tell you the first time we saw her. They only allowed certain people in. You had to put a mask and a gown and all that on. And we looked over in the crib, and she looked like a little squirrel. I just couldn't imagine that was a human being. You know, she's only 2 pounds. And it was really sad because she was such a tiny little thing with all these little things poking out of her side and out of her nose and off of her little arm. She was just like a little ping cushion. They had, you know, all kind of apparatuses coming out of her to try to keep her alive. But, of course, you'd get attached right that minute. Her name is Shaylin Marie. She stayed in the hospital 6 months. So we all suffered through it. And when they got her capable of coming home at like 4 pounds, we got her home, and then they started doing genetic tests, and they found that she was missing her 4th chromosome in her DNA. At that point, you think, oh, nothing we can't work out, you know. It's our little baby, so we'll manage. And, of course, things went downhill. It was more problems than I ever anticipated this child having. The father became AWOL when he realized he had the disabled baby and the things that it was going to require. And the mom, being young, decided to start having friends stay over, and the baby was just there. I mean, it just wasn't a good situation. I think she wanted to take care of the baby, but she also wanted her life, and she'd get depressed. She started popping pills, and a time or two I showed up, and the mama would be asleep in the chair, and it's just something a grandparent would not want to ever see. So I filed suit to get the child's custody. I asked for adoption. We agreed to total custody, and that's how I got the baby by the time she was about a year old. It was something that had to be done. But even during the times we went to court, my granddaughter would come sit by me. You know, she knew I was doing this for the baby. She's 8 years old now, but she is tiny. She looks like maybe a four-year-old. She has real long, pretty hair, thick, pretty hair. And she's got big, pretty eyes. They're like little moon-shaped eyes. She's just always bubbly and happy, and she wants to go. She loves people. She is just an extremely special little girl. She goes to school. We take her, and the teacher meets us because you can't turn her loose. Her little walk is so odd that she'll either trip or fall. And she tells everybody, good morning, you know, or hey. But I have to stay really close to a phone to where if they need me, some days they'll call me after she's there an hour. But I have to be available to go get her. She does have seizures, so if there's any indication she's going into a seizure, they want me there. And I just, you know, I just have to be ready to shut everything down and go. I know there's nothing I can do about it, but I miss all kind of things. I miss getting in the car and going where I want to go. I miss going to a theater and sitting down and watching a movie. I miss doing my hair and my makeup. If I'm halfway through doing the makeup and she's ready to pull me out of that room, then I gotta go. I just grab a comb and lipstick, and that's it. We've just conditioned our life that if she can't go in, we don't go. I gave up some things, but they wasn't that important. There was never a time that I was gonna give up. Mm-mm. I just believe she was sent here for a reason. Sometimes even say she's a little angel, because she touches everybody. I mean, like she's trying to comfort them. We went to Walmart one day, and I was opening the door. Shalem went on in. Well, there was a young guy sitting there. He was bent over, arms on his knees, like he was frustrated. And before I got in the door, I turned around and looked. Shalem had him by the hands, and this man started smiling. And I'm like, she touched him in a way that whatever he was worried about, it seemed lighter. He looked at me and looked at her and smiled. It was the most wonderful smile.
What is the life expectancy of somebody with Shalem's disease?
The last I checked, I think it was about 30 years. We worry about Shalem because I don't know that Shalem would make it that long. There are times when we have health problems with her that we don't know if she's going to make it another day, another week. She still does not eat. Sometimes she gains a little weight. Sometimes she loses weight. Sometimes she doesn't have seizures. Sometimes she does. Sometimes the seizures, she snaps right out of them. Sometimes they're prolonged, and the longer they last, the more it seems like it affects her mental. So we really just don't know. I knew it was going to be a task. I did not realize what a burden it would be. But like I say, the little hugs and kisses, and she can say, I love you, it has made it all worthwhile. If God will let me live as long as she lives, that's my purpose.
You gonna be sweet going to school? Uh-huh. How old are you?
Man.
You're 8. Gonna make a ride to school, aren't you, dear? Do you love school? Mm-hmm. All right, Mama, I'll have to cut it off now.
Shaylin Marie has a genetic condition called Wolff-Hirschhorn syndrome. It affects about 1 in every 50,000 births. It causes heart defects, seizures, and severely stunts physical and mental development. Shaylin lives with Brenda Smith and her husband on their farm in Loosedale, Mississippi. Shaylin's biological mother lives in Florida. That's how everyday bravery forgives and accepts. We always want to hear about your own everyday bravery stories. If you've got one to share, look up Prudential on social media and let us know. You can use the hashtag #EverydayBravery. And don't forget, if you're enjoying the show, help others discover it by leaving a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts. I'm Meg Wilcox. May you be brave in your everyday life. And may your courage help the lives of others. Everyday Bravery, from Prudential. Bring your challenges.